The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Myanmar had been on the road to democracy, but on Monday, the military put a stop to that.
They are showing off their military might with those army tanks rolling in the city. You know, basically, it is traumatizing.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, what it feels like knowing that the service members you trained with helped stage an insurrection.
It confirmed that extremism is within the military, and it's scary for me as a Black woman.
And the psychedelic music scene in 1960s San Francisco, less talked about is how global it was.
There were musicians from Africa, from Middle East, from Indonesia, from Japan, from India, of course, everybody was here.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Democracy has suffered a major blow in Myanmar. In recent years, the country had been moving toward a civilian-led government after decades of ruthless military rule. In November, millions of voters elected new leaders. But then yesterday, as we reported, a coup. The generals from Myanmar's military are now back in charge. Newly elected leaders are in detention, and plenty of citizens are outraged. But what to do about it? Fight back? Wait it out? Seek help from foreign powers? The World's Patrick Nguyen says people inside Myanmar are trying to figure out what comes next.
Kang Nin Wai is a gym teacher living in Naypyidaw, the capital of Myanmar. She likes to get up super early, put on her sneakers, go down to the park, and do aerobics to techno music. She often videos herself for Facebook, and Kang Nin Wai really gets into her routines. So much so that on Monday, she didn't even realize what was happening on the road behind her. A caravan of armored vehicles speeding towards parliament to overthrow the government. She was accidentally documenting a coup. Meanwhile, the rest of the country was waking up, turning on their TVs, and noticing that only one channel, the army's channel, was working. Big announcement. The military is now in charge of everything. The winners of Myanmar's last election in November, they were all gathered in parliament that morning to swear in for a new term. They're now detained. Myanmar's army said, without evidence, that the vote was bogus because their favorite party didn't do so well. And this coup, it has reopened a wound in the country's psyche.
Our people, our society at large, are, I would say, deeply traumatized.
Kin Omar is from Myanmar. She survived a very bloody coup there in 1988. She was a college student then, protesting totalitarian rule. And she eventually had to flee into the jungle. Today, Kin Omar is an activist living in exile in Thailand. She has a big network in Myanmar, and she's worried about people back home. She hasn't been sleeping much, not since a military spokesman said this late last week. We are not saying we will take power, the officer declared, but we're also not saying we won't take power. Seems pretty clear that was a warning. Now the army says it will run the country for up to a year as they plan a, quote, fair election, whatever that means. The top political leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, is under house arrest. Others in her party have been snatched from their homes. Here is a man, the husband of a lawmaker, watching helplessly as soldiers take away his wife in the dead of night.
No.
He also recorded that for Facebook. Seeing this is infuriating for a lot of people. So I asked Kin Omar, what should people do? Go protest like she once did?
I will not say they should or they shouldn't. I will just leave it up to them for their own decision.
Asking people to protest, that's asking a lot. The army is letting everyone know who's in charge.
They are showing off of their military might with those army tanks rolling in the city. You know, basically, it is traumatizing.
So far, there are no big protests. If people are looking to Aung San Suu Kyi for guidance, well, there is this photo of a letter on Facebook that she supposedly wrote. and it looks like instructions for citizens, insinuating they should protest. But there's a big debate about whether the letter is even real. Is it fake news? People don't know. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., the White House is also unsure what to do. Here is spokeswoman Jen Psaki.
We removed sanctions. The United States, I should say, removed sanctions on Burma over the past decade based on progress toward democracy. The reversal of that progress will necessitate an immediate review of our sanctions laws and authorities, followed by appropriate action.
Yet they haven't figured out the right move either. For decades, the U.S. did to Myanmar what it does to Iran and North Korea. Extreme sanctions on the whole economy, basically punishing everyone for the army's misdeeds. Ken Omar says people don't want more of that, especially during the pandemic.
So that kind of general sanction, we are not calling for it. The U.S. need to impose targeted sanctions on the military.
But what would that mean? Well, the mastermind of the coup is Army Chief Min Aung Hlaing. The U.S. already sanctions him over genocidal army purges against indigenous groups, namely the Rohingya Muslims. But what the U.S. could do is go after the military's moneymakers. The army runs this big corporation that has banks and ruby mines and even brews beer. And it's run by military men who are very rich. Again, here's Ken Omar.
The top military elite, military generals, are profiting directly through these conglomerates.
The White House may sanction this company soon, but Myanmar's biggest trading partner, China, won't do anything to the generals. Chinese state media called the coup a cabinet reshuffle. The truth is, there may be no going back to legit elections, not for a while at least. But here's how this coup is different from those in the past. Just 10 years ago, Myanmar was much more isolated. Not many mobile phones, very little internet. But now, everyone is on Facebook. Grandmas, college kids, and of course, dancing PE teachers. It's not all innocent stuff either. There's racism, fake news, confusing rumors. Still, Ken Omar says back in her day, her peers had a limited view of not just the world, but what was happening in their own country. And that is just not true of today's youth.
Compared to our generation, they are even more aware of what happened in the past and what could happen now.
And that gives her some hope that people's eyes are wide open and that they will figure out some way to get their democracy back. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
There is some vaccine news to report out of Russia, and it appears to be good news. According to a new study published by The Lancet, a British medical journal, Russia's Sputnik V vaccine is nearly 92% effective against COVID-19, according to interim trial results. Judy Twigg joins me now to talk about what this means. She's a public health expert at Virginia Commonwealth University. And Judy, your specialty area is in fact Russia, Ukraine, and other parts of Eurasia. The Sputnik V vaccine has been used since the summer, so what have we learned from this new study? What does this change?
It doesn't change anything in terms of what we thought about the vaccine. Even though Russia cut quite a few corners in the development and approval process, it was very much an accelerated timeline. They approved the vaccine back in August, really as they were first beginning phase three clinical trials. But the information that they've been informally reporting all the way through is that the vaccine is safe and effective. What we hear today with this peer-reviewed publication from The Lancet confirms what the Russian government and the vaccine developers have been telling us all along, that the vaccine is highly effective and safe.
Back in August, as you'll remember, when Russia first approved the vaccine, there was a lot of skepticism amongst experts about Sputnik. Why was that?
Russia, going back to the Soviet days, has a fairly well-developed history of making exaggerated or premature claims about its scientific achievements, especially in the biomedical sector. So we have had for a couple of decades some claims coming out of Russia that they've developed an HIV/AIDS vaccine, which of course we have yet to see. They made claims about having developed and deployed in the field vaccines for MERS and for Ebola. Those were overstated claims. So when they announced back in mid-August this vaccine for COVID-19, there was something of a current of, well, there they go again, in response to these claims. But as we've gone forward, as we've seen more development of the vaccine through the clinical trial process, it's become clear that this is a solid vaccine. And so I think most people aren't too surprised that we have the good results that we're seeing published in The Lancet today.
So with those results, fairly impressive results, how do you think, Judy, this will affect the global vaccine market?
Where Sputnik is claiming advantage is in its willingness to make licensing and production deals with vaccine manufacturers all over the world. In other words, they're not holding on to proprietary data as some of the other vaccine companies are. And this is clearly a diplomatic, a foreign policy move. This is Russia's efforts to portray itself as friendly to many of the poor and lower middle income countries around the world who have been left on the sidelines in terms of vaccine distribution. This is Russia's effort to move into a vacuum created by vaccine nationalism of the Western countries, to some extent hoarding so much of the available vaccine supply for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that soft power angle of Sputnik V is there for Russia to exploit, I guess. I mean, some countries have already received shipments of Sputnik V from Russia. Argentina had been desperate for vaccine, and some there thought they were settling on Sputnik V. Now they must be pretty elated with this news. Which other countries are next in line, and what will be the considerations for those countries of whether to go with Sputnik V rather than Pfizer, Moderna, or any of the others?
Well, we're up to dozens of countries around the world that have announced deals with Sputnik V from literally every part of the globe. And for many of those countries, the imperatives of the pandemic are going to outweigh any perceived negative implications of dealing with an authoritarian country like Russia. I'm sure there are many countries that would prefer to be dealing with the United States or Western Europe as their suppliers of vaccines. But it's hard to ignore that cost availability calculation when you're desperate in the middle of a pandemic and now you have a scientifically proven alternative source.
Yeah, elaborate a bit more on that, because I'm wondering what the political role in Russia is for the Sputnik V vaccine. Could this be a heroic moment for Putin that'll give him a shine going forward?
He's already tried to make it that. So back on August 11th, when Russia first approved the Sputnik V vaccine, it was with balloons, confetti, celebration. It was a hugely splashy launch, both globally, but especially inside Russia. They had a very slick website for the vaccine ready to go at the moment they announced its approval on August 11th. It was in seven languages, the website, but most importantly, state-controlled media in Russia has been talking about very little other than this vaccine and its first-in-the-world status, the implications of being first in the world with a COVID vaccine for Russia's reemergence as a scientific great power. You asked whether Putin would want to use today's article in The Lancet as, you know, sort of a political win. He's already been doing that since August. This is very much something that Putin wants to use to reaffirm, to establish the message with the Russian people that his government can reestablish Russia as one of the leading countries in the world.
Judy Twigg, a global public health expert at Virginia Commonwealth University, thank you for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The other big news today out of Russia, Alexei Navalny, the leading figure of Russia's opposition movement, is looking at more than 2.5 years in prison. The sentence comes for violating a parole related to a fraud charge. Navalny says he's innocent in that case. The European Court of Human Rights has called the charge, quote, arbitrary and manifestly unreasonable. Navalny also says that parole violation came because he was in a coma after he was poisoned, a poisoning the Russian government itself is widely believed to have orchestrated. Speaking inside a glass cage in a Moscow courtroom today, Navalny said he was sentenced for a crime that he did not commit. They want to put me in jail in a case in which I have already been found not guilty, Navalny said, in a case that has already been declared fabricated. Navalny's sentence this evening in Moscow comes after days of widespread protests across Russia in support of him, protests that are a direct rebuke of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Navalny's supporters immediately called for more protests. You can find more of our coverage of the Navalny saga and what it means for Russia's opposition movement at theworld.org. Later in the show, the view on President Biden's immigration policy changes from the inside. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In the immediate aftermath of the siege of the U.S. Capitol, active duty U.S. military leaders did not say much. For nearly a week, they were silent. Finally, the Joint Chiefs of Staff issued a statement describing the mob attack as an assault on America's constitutional process and said it was against the law. Some retired members of the U.S. military have been even slower to condemn what happened on January 6th. Just last week, the head of the U.S. Air Academy's Alumni Association, Lieutenant General Michael Gould, was asked if his group's board members thought the attack on the U.S. Capitol was justified. He would not commit.
What we decided upon, and this was through a robust discussion with the board, was that we weren't going to, we made it a point that we would stay totally apolitical, which is very important in what we do, and that we weren't going to pick sides in any of this.
Last night, though, the Air Force Alumni Association seemed to have a change of heart. It issued a statement saying it objected to the assault. Catherine Smith is a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy and a lifetime member of the Air Force Academy Alumni Group. Catherine, what did you think when you heard General Gould, the head of the Air Force Alumni Group, stating last week that the association would not, quote, pick sides on whether the assault was justified on the Capitol? What went through your head?
I was very disappointed in General Gould. I expect more from all of my brother, sister, sibling graduates of the Academy. So I was disappointed and surprised that anybody thought that there were two sides to this issue.
Several of the most prominent rioters on January 6th were from the Air Force. Tell us about them and what kind of stood out when you saw what they had done.
A retired Lieutenant Colonel Brock was one of the people that breached the Senate chamber. He was dressed in military gear. And then I found out later that there were other Air Force Academy graduates at the Capitol that day. It was shocking. It was horrifying. And then you find out that of all the people that were arrested, 20% of them had ties to the military. And it confirmed that extremism is within the military. And when you look at the ties to white national groups and white supremacy, it's scary for me as a Black woman.
Apparently, Mr. Brock was photographed on the Senate floor during the riot, as you said, in military gear, but also carrying zip tie restraints. He was arrested later in Texas, and a federal prosecutor in Texas said that Brock had intended to take hostages, even execute members of Congress. So do you think he and other Air Force Academy graduates will be expelled from the Alumni Association?
I would hope he would be. It's an embarrassment. You know, back when I was a cadet at the Academy, you could be written up for bringing discredit upon the service. And I think Lieutenant Colonel Brock did that.
The Air Force, like the other branches of the U.S. military, it brings together people of very different experiences and backgrounds. It's also deeply polarized. You said a moment ago, this whole situation is really scary for me as a Black woman. When you were in the Air Force Academy, how did you experience these realities?
You know, daily, as a freshman cadet, we call them dualies or 4 degrees. We had to run to class. And so it was typical that an upperclassman would pull you off the strips and ask you questions. And at least once someone said either a racial slur or a sexist term, and then you have to say yes, sir, and then turn around and run back to class. Those incidences stick with me. And at the time, I didn't think there was anything I could do about it. But I experienced things that were clearly sexist, and I experienced things that were clearly racist. So it was the intersectionality of all of my identities that made it a tough place for me.
Catherine, speaking of the intersection of racism and sexism, we saw Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on Instagram talking very candidly about the re-traumatization of her own experience of assault. That, like the assault on Capitol Hill, she has been told to move on. How have you been processing that point of view since January 6th?
Yes, I've been following AOC's Instagram, and I felt sad. And I think it re-traumatizes anyone who's ever been helpless or threatened with violence. So I commend her for speaking out and sharing that trauma publicly. Yeah, it was tough to watch.
Catherine, when you were in the Air Force Academy, did you ever think the Air Force was an organization that could include even support members who were guided by white nationalism or white supremacy?
I didn't think it at the time. Yeah, I was a young 18 to 22-year-old, and I've been really hopeful to get the support of white classmates, of Hispanic classmates and fellow grads, that they're speaking out and they want to root out extremism in our military as much as I do.
How do you think white supremacy can be rooted out in the U.S. Armed Forces?
The first step is to acknowledge that it exists. One of the other steps is you sign up voluntarily to join the military. The Department of Defense has a right to know what other organizations and groups you belong to. I think it's appropriate to search people's social media. It's appropriate that they ban Nazi flags and Confederate flags from dorm rooms and barrack rooms. I think it's appropriate to change the name of Army bases from Confederate leaders. But I think the biggest step is to acknowledge it and remove those people who share those views.
The overt white supremacy in some corners of the military, I mean, it seems like we're facing a situation as if we need the armed forces to protect us from some elements in the armed forces. What is the proper role of the U.S. military when it comes to rooting out an internal threat, like the one posed by the people who launched the assault on the Capitol on January 6th?
It's a national security issue. If the soldier in the field can't trust the soldier next to them to support and defend them, how do we fight the enemy? And it causes dissension in the ranks.
Do you feel like it's an uphill battle, or do you feel like you've got the majority of the armed services and the veterans on your side?
I'd like to hope the majority of veterans, the majority of active duty military don't share those views, but there are enough out there that causes me concern. There are times that I'm scared. I'm almost positive that, you know, after people hear this, I'll probably get some messages that are not nice.
So if there was a young woman, a friend or relative of yours who said, I want to enter the Air Force, what would you tell them?
My great nephew just joined the Army about 6 months ago, and I'm proud of him because the military can be a place where you can learn and grow and help your future. But if I had a friend, male or female, that asked me about it, I think you have to give people the truth. Attending the United States Air Force Academy was perhaps the best thing that I did for my life. It got me out of my small town in Kansas. It gave me skills and an education, but I don't know that I would do it again, knowing what I know now.
Lawyer Catherine Smith is a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy and a member of the Air Force Academy alumni group. Catherine, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Marco. I really appreciated you bringing this issue to the forefront.
You're listening to The World. President Biden's climate change policies don't only look at scientific solutions. There's also a focus on environmental justice, helping communities most impacted by policy.
And this makes me really excited. Finally, we seem to have a president in the United States that understands the problem.
Also ahead, how the pandemic is fueling discrimination against some communities. Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The COVID pandemic has hit marginalized groups the hardest. In many countries, there's been a big push to collect and publish data by race in order to expose these disparities, but that's backfiring in some communities where the data has translated into discrimination. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
A few weeks ago, Jared Williams' cousin called the phone company to set up a new landline.
And they asked her right away, where's your house at?
She told them. Williams and his cousin are members of Cowichan Tribes, the largest First Nation in British Columbia. They both live on its reserve on Canada's scenic Vancouver Island.
And they said, we're not really working on reserve right now. Oh, she's mad.
He says reserve residents have been hearing that a lot. It started in early January when the reserve announced a spike in COVID infections and declared a shelter-in-place order with exceptions for members to go to school, work, or shops.
Everybody, when they heard that, there was a lot of this assumption that, okay, so now the Aboriginal people are not allowed to leave the reserve at all. all 5,000 of us have to stay home.
That's a misunderstanding, but Williams says it persists. He says his family's favorite restaurant refused to deliver to them. Reserve residents visiting shops have overheard others saying they shouldn't be there because they have COVID-19. And he says area dentists have been declining to treat reserve residents.
The virus is all the way across the island. It's on the mainland. It's in all communities. Why are we the ones who are not allowed to access these services?
The thing is that up until this point, Cowichan Tribes had been a model community when it came to keeping COVID out. Then, its general manager Derek Thompson says, people probably got together with extended family over Christmas and New Year's. By January 1st, they had two cases.
The second we announced it, right away the racist, discriminatory rants started on social media mostly.
3 weeks later, they had 90 cases. Reportedly, some people in towns outside the reserve demanded that companies fire employees who are Cowichan Tribes members.
We make every effort to meet with those proprietors in an effort to inform them and work it out as opposed to just letting it sit.
But what Cowichan Tribes members have experienced isn't unique, says Nicole Da Silva. She's an assistant professor of political science at Concordia University in Quebec who studies human rights. Da Silva says at the beginning of the pandemic, advocates pushed for racial data to be collected in order to identify the factors that lead to disparities.
That led to, ironically in a way, stigmatization of particular communities that had disproportionately high infection rates.
She says when COVID infection data about specific communities is made public, it can lead to problems. Da Silva says Indigenous people and East and South Asian Canadians have been spit on, yelled at, or had their businesses boycotted.
So it's really this double-edged sword for vulnerable communities. It can actually encourage discrimination and resentment towards those vulnerable populations.
But Da Silva says businesses can't just stop serving customers from certain communities or certain areas, even if they're under COVID restrictions. By law, she says, businesses have to make reasonable accommodations. They have to take precautionary measures like using protective equipment or offer alternatives like curbside pickup.
It can't just be, well, we know there are infections in this community, and so therefore we can just apply these blanket restrictions on this community. We're sort of well beyond that, I think, now.
Derek Thompson, Cowichan Tribe's general manager, got fed up with the incidents of racism and discrimination and decided to do something about it.
You can either focus on the nastiness of it or you can focus on what's the positive here and what momentum can we build from that.
He reached out to nearby mayors and other leaders and invited them to talk about what was happening. Here's a sample of some of their video statements to the public.
Cowichan Tribes has been totally transparent about the struggles they're having with COVID-19. And as a result of that, we've seen racist, derogatory comments and people pushing to further divide us.
These hard days have been made even harder and more hurtful because of racism.
We know our communities have never really been strangers to racism, and it's really unfortunate that we are seeing it rear its ugly head once again.
It's not okay to ask somebody, do you live on the Cowichan Reserve, and then refuse service if the answer is yes.
This is nothing unique to the Cowichan First Nation. This is affecting all of us.
Let's focus on being the community that we really want to be.
Let us come together, and when we see racism, call it out.
Cowichan Tribes leaders hailed the outpouring of support, but Tribes member Jared Williams wonders how racism can be addressed without talking about specific incidents or calling out perpetrators.
How do you get reconciliation if you don't acknowledge racism?
Discrimination based on COVID-19 infections didn't come out of nowhere, Williams says, and without deep self-examination, it won't just go away. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Nearly 2,250,000 people have died from COVID-19 in this pandemic. Today, we sadly need to report that one of them is Captain Tom Moore. The British World War II veteran became a global hero this spring when he walked laps in his garden to raise money for the UK's National Health Service. Yesterday, we mentioned Moore had been stricken with COVID. Today, Moore's family announced that he died. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson remembered Moore this way.
It's quite astonishing that at the age of 100, he raised more than £32 million for the NHS on his own, and so gave countless others their own chance to thank the extraordinary men and women who have protected us throughout this pandemic.
£32 million, that's more than $40 million. During his garden fundraiser last spring, Captain Tom Moore encouraged people to, quote, always remember tomorrow will be a good day. Today, though, we honor you, Captain Moore. Some big changes to American immigration policy today. Three executive orders signed by President Biden. One seeks to reunite separated families. A second order to improve access for asylum seekers. And a third, removing barriers to legal immigration to the U.S. All of these policy changes will be implemented by federal government workers who need to get up to speed pretty quickly. Michael Knowles is president of AFGE Local 1924, a union that represents more than 2,000 employees with U.S. citizenship and immigration services in the D.C. area. He says while they wait for details on how to implement the new policies, there is something else to consider, having enough experienced immigration officers to do the work.
During the last administration, we suffered the loss of a lot of our most experienced officers due to turnover, retirement, and many people, frankly, left the program because they did not want to be part of the terrible things that the administration was doing. So we're ready to go to help build back better and to protect refugees. But we're going to need resources to hire up, retrain, and possibly try to bring back some of the talent that left us.
So you said that you want to see the immigration system built back better. So you support the changes so far? Do you want to see more?
Yes, we support the changes, and we want to see more.
The Biden immigration policies do represent a 180-degree shift in philosophy from the Trump administration. I'm just wondering how immigration officers are taking in that big shift in culture.
The folks that I represent welcome the changes. As I said, they're concerned that we get the support that we need to carry them out. But I think also we have to look at addressing some of the damage, the great damage that was done. So it's one thing to rescind an order or issue a new order, but there are a lot of people who were harmed by the old order. And we would like to see some steps taken by the administration to redress some of those harms.
I'm curious, when you were watching your colleagues leave, why did you stay?
I stayed because as the union president, I had a platform to speak out about it. The average employee is not permitted to speak on public policy issues. But as a union representative, I was able to try to work within to mitigate some of the damage. We have taken a number of actions to speak out about these issues and bring public pressure to change these policies. And that's really why I stayed around.
Michael, you've mentioned a few times that you're motivated to help refugees and asylum seekers. I'm wondering, is there a particular asylum case that has really stuck with you and kind of why it reinforces your desire to stay in these immigration services?
I can't think of any one particular case. I see more of a collage of many thousands of cases that I've done over the years. When we think of refugees, we think of the people who've sat in front of us, the folks who have fled genocide in various parts of the world, people who risk their lives crossing deserts or open seas. Those stories remain with us and motivate us to continue doing the mission that we have. And the other thing that motivates us is we see folks that have obtained asylum in the U.S. go on to become residents and American citizens and proud and patriotic citizens, and that who've helped to build our country and make it the great country that it is.
So many presidents have been unable to get immigration reform done. If Biden also fails, what else could he be doing? Or do you think executive orders are the extent of what we might see?
I remain hopeful that members of Congress will see it as a national priority to pass some kind of comprehensive immigration reform. But in the meantime, there are many things that the president can do through executive order. And a lot of with respect to asylum and refugees, a lot of what we do is governed by law. And we've argued, our union has argued, that many of the Trump administration's policies were indeed unlawful, and they prevented us, the workers, from doing the things that we were sworn to do when we swore to uphold the Constitution and faithfully administer the laws of the United States.
Michael Knowles is the president of AFGE Local 1924, a union representing employees of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In his first weeks in office, President Biden signed a big batch of executive orders on climate change. They included a focus on environmental justice, i.e., who is impacted by climate change. Historically, poorer communities and people of color have been most impacted by environmental problems. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with Chukwumerijie Okereke about how this focus could have impacts beyond the U.S. Okereke is a former director at the Center for Climate and Justice in the U.K., also a visiting professor at Oxford University. He said Biden's new focus signifies an important shift.
By making climate justice a priority, Biden shows that he understands the problem, that we have to, of course, invest in the technological innovation, in understanding the science, but crucially in making sure that those who are contributing the least to this problem are not allowed to suffer and bear the greatest brunt of the impact of climate change.
President Biden's new climate envoy, of course, is John Kerry. And after he presented a plan to create a White House Council on Environmental Justice, he said this.
The world will measure us by what we can do here at home. So with these executive actions, we believe we're steps further down that journey.
What message does this focus on environmental justice show to the rest of the world?
I share completely with John Kerry that charity, as they say, has to begin at home. But it also should signal that at the global level, the U.S. government will take a leading role in ensuring that justice is put in the center of global cooperation or international cooperation to address climate change.
Well, you're from Nigeria, a country with a big oil industry. Many other countries also still rely heavily on coal, oil, and gas. The Biden administration has signaled a commitment to phase out these fossil fuels. How would that impact places like Nigeria? I mean, there could be a negative impact since Nigeria relies on fossil fuels for income.
Exactly. We must make sure that countries like Nigeria that have been reliant on oil are carried along, are supported, and that the transition is undertaken in such a way that it is just and equitable, so that those who have relied on oil, especially oil workers, but the country at large, do not suffer significant harm or disproportionately from a disjointed and unstructured and unplanned or rapid transition. Now, I often tell my American friends that the battle for climate change will be won or lost, not so much in developed countries or industrialized countries, but actually in developing countries, in India, in China, Nigeria, South Africa, these are the epicenters, as it were, for future economic development. And if the world does not come together to support these countries that are experiencing the greatest increase in emissions, but also that have the legitimate right to aspire to increase their well-being or economic development status, then what you will see is that even if emissions become flat or even decrease significantly in the developed countries, the rise in emissions in these developing countries will cancel out whatever results that are achieved in the developed world. So it's important not only that the developed countries show leadership, but also that they provide the support that is necessary for those in poor but rapidly developing countries to take action.
Do you think Biden's focus on environmental justice might influence other world leaders to change their own domestic approach to climate policy? I mean, could Biden be starting a trend?
Well, those of you in America will always like to claim standing a trend, but quite frankly, there are many countries that are already ahead of you. Here in the UK, Scotland has been leading the way in mapping fair and just patterns of approaching the green transition and focusing specifically, actually, on how to reskill workers that have been working in the oil industries. Make no mistake about it. The fact that Biden is focusing on climate justice will have huge implications globally. But there are some nations that are ahead of you in this regard.
That was Chukwumerije Okoroike, the former director of the Center for Climate and Justice in the UK. He was speaking there with my colleague, Carol Hills. From Myanmar to Mauritania, the world connects you to people and stories across the globe. Continue that connection online. Follow us on Twitter for more on the stories that change your world. We are at The World. I want to tell you about an extraordinary just-released recording of Indian ragas, and there's a wild backstory to it and the man who actually recorded it. So let's start there, and for that we need to go back to January 31st, 1970, 51 years ago.
Hey, I got a statement to make that...
A show by the Grateful Dead in New Orleans.
A blatant attempt on the part of the establishment to keep rockers from coming here.
The Dead and their traveling legion of fans had been hassled by the police since they'd arrived in town.
Ooh, all good. Now I'm going to do a little paranoid fantasy song for you.
Something was in the air, but the show went on.
In the timbers of the Nary Old, the wolves are running round.
A few hours later, the band was back at their hotel with their sound engineer, Owsley Stanley, who also happened to be one of the most prolific producers of LSD in history, and the police busted all of them for drug possession. Owsley Stanley would begin a 2-year prison sentence later that same year. With that in his future, Owsley continued working steadily for several more months as a sound engineer back home in San Francisco.
And now Ustad Ali Akbar Khan Sarod, Indranil Bhattacharya Sitar, and Zakir Hussain Tabla will perform rags. Coffee, Jilla Coffee, followed by...
Owsley Stanley had what he called his sonic journals, exceptionally high-quality analog recordings that also served as labs in his never-ending quest for the best sound possible. This concert is part of that collection, Three Masters of Music from the Asian Subcontinent. It happened in May of 1970, on the eve of Owsley's prison term. After his release, he and Zakir Hussain got to know each other pretty well. Zakir found Owsley to be, with certain things, completely monofocused.
I mean, I remember some years later, he walked into my apartment in San Anselmo and said, Zakir, we should move to Maui, up the volcano, because the world is going to end next year. We have to go because that's the only safe place on this earth. He actually did move to Maui. And then eventually to Australia. But when he decided that something had to be done, nothing on the periphery was going to in any way distract him.
Owsley Stanley recorded this session of ragas at what was the hangout for the Grateful Dead in San Francisco, the Family Dog.
My first encounter with Owsley was there at the Family Dog. This was this maniac running around all over the stage, you know, tripping over wires and falling and getting up and running and setting up microphone stands and setting up microphones and then running back to his Nagra machine on the side of the stage and put his headphones on and listen for a minute and then throw his headphones off and run back. And he was a man possessed and with this idea in his head, moved the microphones, but also recorded in a way where people could actually close their eyes and know where the musicians were sitting on the stage.
Resulting in what you're hearing now. There's a deep respect, a reverence almost, in Owsley's desire to get the sound right, for this music especially. Zakir Hussain had already picked up on that perception of Indian music through his introduction to American audiences.
No, I had just come from India, and I was still coming to grips with what the audiences were like here. My first encounter was at Fillmore East in New York, playing with Pandit Ravi Shankar. And I sat down on the stage, and it was dark in the hall, and there was an incredible smell. And I said, what is this smell? And then I finally realized that the whole audience, each one of them, was holding a burning incense in their hand. So just imagine 1,000 incenses, what kind of a smell that would have.
Wow. And that presumably never happens in India.
Oh, it never happens in India. And in India, you can see the audience. Here, you couldn't see the audience. And in India, in those days, you could have an interaction with the audience. Somebody would shout out, yeah, that's great, do that again, and stuff like that. But there was not that kind of an interaction.
But something else did happen. Something Zakir Hussain was not expecting.
Automatically, as a defensive mechanism, it became obvious to us as musicians, we were going to interact with each other. It wouldn't matter what the audience was doing. And that raised the level of conversation, musical conversation that was happening amongst us, to a whole different level.
Ali Akbar Khan, who plays Sarod here, had just founded his world-famous music school in San Rafael in 1970. And with the kind of artistic epiphany Zakir Hussain had at the Family Dog, he joined what was a special California scene, a scene that gets less attention than its psychedelic reputation.
I would say like a global musical renaissance happening in the Bay Area, because there were musicians from Africa, from Middle East, from Indonesia, from Japan, from India, of course, everybody was here. And there was this growing awareness among musicians who were native of this place that there was a lot of music in the world that they should connect with. So there was an incredible interaction going on. And I just happened to arrive there in the right place at the right time.
And stayed until today. The recording produced by Owsley Stanley, the Grateful Dead soundman, featuring Zakir Hussain, Usted Ali Akbar Khan, and Indranil Bhattacharya, is titled That Which Colors the Mind. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. You stay safe, be strong, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.